Okay, can you see if this gate's open? We're looking for A45? Plot A, or section A, plot 45.
42?
45. It was 45.
Are you sure it was 45?
I thought it was 42. Ooh. Do you see any plot markers?
When you wander around one of New England's oldest cemeteries, you never really quite know where you'll end up. Traveled to Eastern Cemetery in Portland, Maine, in search of one of the most prolific stone cutters of the 19th century.
It's really disorienting to try to find a grave that isn't attached to a plot, or it's just on its own, and that's so strange.
Look at the way they're just sort of like thrown in here, too.
No, they're not like planned.
Exactly, they're not.
There's just like dig a hole, his room here. It's very willy-nilly.
As we walked through the gates, we were met with uneven ground sprinkled with a dizzying maze of ornate stones, many restored to their original condition. The oldest grave here is that of Mary Green. Her burial was in 1717, 60 years before our subject was even born. The sun starts sinking through the trees, and the wind whips around us as we try to locate one of the smallest, most unassuming stones nestled in the overgrown brush. For a man who revolutionized the way gravestones are carved, his own is modest and not easy to spot.
That's nowhere!
Where is it? Someone eat it? Right now. Ooh, that's not it, is it?
Here lies the grave of Bartlett Adams, an unsung hero of New England and one of the first men to turn stone cutting into a business. When we die, where will we go and who will remember us? Join us as we unravel the mysterious past of New England residents and visit the vessels that keep them. Share stories lost to time.
And this is Anna Adams.
Ashes to ashes, and dust to dust. This is
buried in time. The year is 1800, and at just 24 years of age, Bartlett Adams, a young stone cutter from Kingston, Massachusetts, arrives in the bustling seaside town of Portland, Maine. He's single, talented, and has a bit of money in his pockets when he sets foot on Maine soil. Many families have already settled in the well-established area over the last 150 years, with access to much of everything they could need. Everything except gravestones. On that September day, Adams probably had a little inkling that he would become such an important fixture in the local funerary business. But considering mortality rates during his era was nearly one death every 3 days, it's no surprise that his first stone cutting shop would be in extremely high demand. Born on October 24th, 1776, to Francis Howard Adams and Rebecca Cook Adams, Bartlett had two brothers and an older sister, Lucy, whose nuptials to stonecutter Bildad Washburn would help carve out his future profession. At 15, he became Washburn's apprentice, and he spent several years working in shops throughout Boston before his move to Maine to seek his own riches. For Bartlett, Portland was a wise choice, as there were no competitors in an already thriving economy. He purchased 4 plots of land and set up shop at the corner of Federal and Fish Streets. Today, it's called Exchange Street, just a short walk from Eastern Cemetery. He published his first advertisement in the Eastern Argus and proclaimed his list of available services. This included decorative stonework, such as mantelpieces and door jambs, which were in great need during the building boom of the early 19th century. This work kept him quite busy, but it was the gravestone carving jobs that would catapult his career. Eastern Cemetery, originally known as the Town Burying Ground, was the only cemetery for Portland residents. Since 1668, the six-acre parcel of land served as a final resting place for many families, pocked with fresh grave sites, already crowded by the time Bartlett arrived. This particular cemetery was open to the townspeople to find any available plot which was unused, if they could. It was so full, in fact, that it is rumored that when an empty plot was selected for burial, one would often begin digging only to find the bones of a current tenant. No laws were in place to regulate such burials until 1765. So this explains the unruly and somewhat chaotic layout of these ancient grounds. The earliest markers would have been commissioned by shops located in Boston, something only the wealthy could afford, as the boat ride south was often more costly than the gravestone itself. With the opening of Adams' shop, well-to-do families no longer had to make an arduous journey to Boston during their time of grief, and working-class families could now afford to purchase a stone for their loved ones. His first year in business saw at least 100 deaths in Portland, so he quickly became busy. The popular stonecutter primarily served those interred at the local burying ground. However, his work has been discovered in at least 132 cemeteries throughout New England. The earliest gravestones crafted during his years in Massachusetts were of great detail, but in the first few years of business in Portland, it became much simpler as he strived to keep up with the overabundance of orders. We wanted to know more about the intricacies of Bartlett's life. In our research, Anna and I uncovered a book about the very subject, Early Gravestones in Southern Maine, The Genius of Bartlett Adams. After reading this book full of fascinating details, we made another discovery. The author, Ron Romano, was a local man. We sent him an email to see if he'd meet with us. A few weeks later, he did. On a warm, sunny Friday the 13th, Ron unlocked the gates of Eastern Cemetery and brought us back in time to the 19th century, on the very grounds where Bartlett's work has been showcased for over 200 years.
How many people have a key to this cemetery?
The Friends group, which is what I'm part of, which is called Spirits Alive, most of the board members do, I'd say probably like five or six, and then every tour guide, which is 10 of us, because we have to lock and unlock the gates.
Ron leads us to what is arguably one of the most famous stones in the cemetery. This is one you have to go see in person. The grave of Bartlett Adams' first son is a work of art. The elaborate, fine details carved by the hand of a father in mourning.
So there's Bartlett Jr. That's the first of seven kids. He lived only 5-6 months, as you can see. And then the second was George, who died in 1809. He only lived a few hours. And then Eliza, who's 1812, she only lived a few hours as well. The story with the family is that he and Charlotte, his wife, Charlotte Neal, had seven children, but six of them predeceased him. So Bartlett, the namesake son, was the first to die, and the stone, as you can see from the decoration, is really beautifully done. I mean, it's one of his finest works ever. It's just got a mix of, you know, there's the family shield with birds and globes, celestial globes, and then cross fronds at the top. There's this background stippling, which would have taken a lot of time to do. And then notice in the banner below, it's in Latin, Memoria Sacrum, which is in sacred memory. So Bartlett knew Latin, and he did put it on a number of his markers.
We're standing at the graves of three of Bartlett's deceased children, Eliza, George, and Bartlett Jr. But there's more here than meets the eye, much more. Ron's told us that although there are over 2,000 gravestones here, in reality, there are over 7,000 people buried beneath Eastern Cemetery. We see the names Eliza, George, and Bartlett in front of us, but is that who lies beneath our feet?
Bartlett, George, and Eliza, 3 years apart, were buried here when they died. He goes away shortly after Eliza dies to the farm, comes back in 1814, and then daughter Sarah dies early in 1815. She doesn't have a marker. It's because she's in the family tomb. The interesting story here is that of all the records, burial records that were created for the cemetery, there are a handful of people that have two listings. And guess what? Bartlett, George, and Eliza are three of those who have a second listing in the family tomb. So I just thought that was odd, and I put it aside. I didn't do anything with that information, just thought, well, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
He points to a grave just to the front of the three children's graves. It's off to the side a bit, but oddly close to the other stones. The name on it is Margaret Tukey.
What I since discovered is that Margaret Tukey is listed as being buried in George Adams' grave. And what that means is, when he bought the tomb, Sarah went in there, his first child. I believe he had the three kids disinterred and put in his tomb to be with the family.
Yep.
Left the stones because this is great advertising for him. It's to show the community what kind of work he does. So this plot lies empty until many, many years later when Margaret Tukey dies and they put her there because the place was full and there was no room.
As we walk around the uneven ground, we can't help but wonder what it might have looked like decades ago. Before our grandmothers were born. Before our great-grandmothers were even born. Ron walks us over to the area where the Adams family tomb is located, a short stroll from the graves of the three children. All that remains today is badly worn pieces of stone, and it's a little heartbreaking to look at, to see what the combination of weather, time, and vandalism has done to something so sacred. During the peak of Bartlett's success, walking these paths looked a lot different. Here's Anna to tell you more about what life looked like in early 19th century New England. She just moved to Maine from California, so this will be fun research for her.
Encompassing the states of Maine, Connecticut, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, it's the oldest, clearly defined territory of the United States. New England predates the American Revolution by more than 150 years. This area is both blessed and cursed by its climate. With gorgeous seasonal variations, New England boasts breathtakingly beautiful autumns, with more colors of leaves than one could ever imagine. Many flock to Maine for its beaches and lakes in the summer months. Cemeteries are quaintly tucked in between every small town, and lighthouses decorate the rocky seaside. It's probably one of the most charming places in the nation, but also has some of the most wicked weather patterns in history. New England faces long and bitterly cold winters. Unforgiving in length and notoriously known for substantial snowfall, it's not for the faint of heart. The year 1816 was known as the year without a summer in New England because 6 inches of snow fell in June and every month of the year had a hard frost. Temperatures dropped to as low as 40 degrees in July and August. The year without a summer had a far-reaching impact. Crop failures caused hoarding and big price increases for agricultural commodities. People went hungry. Thousands died. New England as a whole was the most industrialized part of the U.S. By 1850, it was also the most literate and most educated region in the country. It was the center of the American anti-slavery movement and has long been a leading force in American literature and higher education. The region was the manufacturing center of the United States for much of the 19th century, and it played an important role during and after the American Civil War. By the 19th century, industrialization throughout New England brought about rapid changes in everyday life. The newly rich accumulated a never-ending supply of novelties from the many factories and workshops that spread across the area. The dreadful working and living conditions of the early 19th century persisted throughout New England until the end of the Victorian era. The middle class now could also afford to hire help, and many young women were in servitude during the 19th century. The poor were hired and even auctioned off or sold as servants, a practice which bordered on slavery. Doing anything to avoid going to the poorhouse, New Englanders reluctantly joined this workforce, having no other choice in order to survive. Poorhouses were maintained with public funds to house the homeless and most destitute. Many, didn't make it out of the poorhouse alive. New England saw its fair share of epidemics, teaching us that these afflictions arrived with terrifying quickness and grim mortality rates. Smallpox, diphtheria, and there wasn't a single citizen that had not been touched by the loss of a friend or family member to consumption. Sisters, mothers, sons, daughters, fathers were lost to the omnipresent disease. It was an intimate, if unwelcome, part of everyone's daily lives. They were frighteningly aware of its symptoms, the flushed cheeks, the gleaming eyes, fever, loss of appetite, and most of all, the cough. Dreaded and yet romanticized, its victims slowly slipping away, their physical bodies leaving us, or their immortal souls hung over the sky, creating a deathly shadow in its cast. Disease such as this would not be put to rest until the advent of antibiotics and more advanced medicine came along. Life in New England in the 19th century was anything but easy.
So these are box tombs, and while some of them are just air, this one you can see, because the top is missing, it's just a solid block of granite. So yeah, so bodies are all in below. So these are four rows of underground family tombs that the well-to-do of the town could have purchased for their use. Each one has a private stairway. Each one would have held up to 30 people. This is the Bartlett Adams tomb, and only this base slab remains. See the pins? That would have had six columns holding up a ledger slab. So it's no doubt that when Sarah died in 1815, Bartlett had this ledger slab on here. He was a carver. He probably put all four kids' names, because they were the first four to die, on that ledger slab, which, as you can see, is long since gone. There is so much vandalism in the cemetery over the hundreds of years it's been around. People steal the columns, they come in and break things, and so there's many, many markers missing and broken and illegible like this. The tomb would have been purchased by Bartlett in the 1814-15 time frame. His daughter, who grew up and married Charles Rogers, is buried in here.
Right.
And I believe that when Bartlett died, or soon before he died, Rogers, having married into the family, purchased half of the tomb order for their family. He assumed they were going to have a big family that all end up here too.
Yeah.
So this is simply a entrance marker, so the stairway to the tomb is here and goes underneath.
Everything is filled in now, and standing there, it's hard to believe at one time, elaborate stone steps took you underground to a tomb large enough for 30 people. Ron's description finally helps me get my bearings, though. This is one of the most labyrinth-like cemeteries I've been to. But now I'm starting to understand why stones were placed in certain locations, and why so many graves are still unmarked. We see a lot of common themes among stones from this time period, and we want to know more about the symbolism.
So let's talk a little bit about how, you know, when he gets here, what was going on. So prior to 1800, the New England basic iconography on grave markers was winged faces, winged skulls. And the notion there, whether it's the skull which represents the deceased or the human face which represents a soul effigy, the wings that are attached represent the resurrection, so the flying of the soul to heaven. And down in Boston especially, you know, all the shops are just pumping out like crazy these human faces. Bartlett is a journeyman, an apprentice and a journeyman during that phase. So he learned that style from his brother-in-law. That was a style that he did a lot of, which is the winged human face. He didn't do any skeleton imagery. So when he shows up in Portland, he's bringing with him stuff that he's learned, his lettering and numbering skills, his, you know, designs. But he makes them his own, like all the stonecutters did. They would learn a design and then make it their own, and that would become their signature look. He had a bunch of those, and he was such a talented carver and, you know, so skilled in his lettering and numbering that he was able to produce a good variety of symbols. So he has, in the earliest years, the winged faces, which is the resurrection of the soul. He had sunrises. He did about 35 of those. And what was cool about the sunrises is that he personified them. So you see the eyebrows on the eyes, and it's peeking up over the horizon rather than just a sun. I'll show you one over here.
He leads us to a stone that's topped with the rising sun. It's subtle, but you can see human eyes and eyebrows etched in, which gives you a whimsical, warm feeling. To be honest, it's cute as hell. We move down the row of stones, and there's one that even stumps Ron.
He did a really unique set of umbrellas or canopies. There's probably a dozen of those in here.
He told us today, researchers still can't figure out what the umbrellas are meant to symbolize.
The design that really took hold in the 1800s, which was when he was active, is the urn and the willow. And the urn is a Greek revival symbol, and many of the urns have actually flame coming out of the top. But the urn symbolizes death. The willow tree represents mourning, so you have death and mourning on one stone. And he did a ton of those, and there's many, many of them in here. What you find in stones that Bartlett and the guys that work in the shop created is an interesting broken branch on each willow, and that's to represent the life cut off or the life cut short. And so when you walk through and look at an urn and a willow, if you look closely, you'll see that broken branch on the willow tree, yeah.
At first glance, this is something I would have never noticed. But we're curious about the urns. In today's world, companies would surely use a template or find a handy way to expedite the process. What did Bartlett do? Was he using a template? Or did he freehand these elaborate illustrations?
One of his signature urns is the urn with what I call urn with bunting. And people have asked me before if he had a template that he just like traced. And I studied the design to see if I could answer it. And I was able to answer the question. No, he did it all.
Basically?
Yeah, he was just really, really talented. I mean, he had a mallet and a chisel, and he would just like pound, pound, pound and make those lines. And it took a lot of time. Every letter takes 10 or 12 minutes to carve. So on a marker with a big inscription, it would have taken a really long time just to do the inscription. But then the design and the basic finishing work and all that, you know, it would take days, if not a week, to do a typical slate marker.
It's pretty amazing. We're looking at a sea of over 3,000 stones, and nearly one-third of these were crafted by Bartlett's hands and the hands of the men in his shop. Freehand with only a few tools, 200 years ago. Ron tells us all the men in his shop had similar styles, but he can always tell Bartlett's apart. It's like handwriting, he says. Something really interesting happened to Ron when he first began doing research on Bartlett Adams. Something that nearly made him fall out of his chair. He was sitting at his desk one day, putting together Bartlett's family tree. He saw some of Bartlett's relatives came from the Mayflower. Ron had some relatives that came from the Mayflower, too. He took out his notes to compare names. Turns out, those were his relatives, too. That's right. While already in the midst of becoming Bartlett Adams' biographer, Ron discovered they're distant relatives. Pretty cool. With all this fascination and even genetic connection to Bartlett, we had to ask Ron, has he ever had any contact with the descendants? Here's Anna with the answer to that question.
While sifting through Bartlett's family tree, Ron came upon some descendants that were still alive and living in Colorado. He sent them a letter. He asked if they had any information about the old stonecutter from New England. Any remaining relics? Anything at all? A picture? A keepsake? Some sort of tangible evidence of this man of mystery? And they sure did. With Bartlett's original handwriting inscribed within its pages, they had none other than his family Bible. What a find! He very subtly and graciously offered to take it off their hands should they not want it. And 3 years later, he received a phone call. They asked him, "Do you still want the Bible?" What do you think his answer was? But Ron knew it needed to be preserved and shared. So after unboxing the fragile heirloom himself and soaking in his late relative's most sacred artifact, he donated the good book to Portland's Historical Society. Another interesting thing to note is what was inside his Bible. Or more accurately, what wasn't. While Bartlett carefully documented every one of his children's births and deaths and the details of each, there remains no complete record for himself. Scrawled in another's penmanship is one single line of text simply stating, "Bartlett Adams died January 27, 1828, Sunday, 9:30 p.m. So how did he die? Well, we just don't know.
As the sun begins to set over the Atlantic, we say farewell to our new friend and reflect on all the beauty of Eastern Cemetery. Over 7,000 people rest here eternally, and Bartlett's story is only one of those. We're so excited to begin this journey of peeking into the unknown and the forgotten. We can't wait to take you with us through the unexplored, to family burying grounds, and dark corners of New England that no one seems to visit anymore. From the bottom of our creepy, dark hearts, thank you for joining us for episode 1. Before we go, we want to give you a little info on some of the important work Ron's doing and Spirits Alive, the volunteer-based group that preserves and beautifies Portland's oldest burying ground. Here's Anna.
Thanks to Spirits Alive, an organization in Portland, Maine that is dedicated to the preservation and beautification of Eastern Cemetery, over 500 gravestones have been restored. They also give daily tours of the old burying grounds. And Ron, he's still giving tours of other cemeteries throughout Maine, the next of which was booked up within mere hours. You also won't want to miss his books. There's three. The first, which we owe a great deal of credit to, as much of the information used in this episode comes from it. It's also got even more grim and fascinating tales of the time. It's titled Early Gravestones in Southern Maine, The Genius of Bartlett Adams. You can find his writings on Amazon, local Maine bookstores, but the best way to get a signed copy is through Ron himself. Shoot him an email at roroman@maine.rr.com.
Next week on Buried in Time, join us for a Lost Stories episode where Anna and I bring you an unscripted conversation. Just two best friends having a cocktail and regaling over strange history. Then, we're back with another cemetery visit on September 18th. Come with us to Poland, Maine, as we untangle a gruesome murder scene from 1856. As above, so below. Ashes to ashes, and dust to dust.
Rest in peace, Bartlett Adams.
Buried in Time is brought to you by Folia Du Productions. This episode was produced, edited, and narrated by Allison DeWitt and Anna Adams. Creative direction by Benjamin Adams. Associate production by Vivian Humanick and Emmeline Adams. Music by Vivek Abushek. And voiceovers by me, your friendly ghoul from the underworld, Mr. Corny. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to leave a review on iTunes to help like-minded mortals find us. For more information on your favorite episodes or to support the show, visit buriedintimepod.com. That's buriedintimepod.com. Join us next week, if you dare.